Welcome, welcome, welcome to the French Connections Wednesday edition. Today's date is October 18th, 2006. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith. It's great to have you here for this second interview of the week here with a good friend of mine, someone I've actually had a relationship with for some time. Started it out some months ago when he began emailing me with information he had discovered in doing research. And at the time, it was unable to actually share it for some solid reasons. He was involved in an employment that would not allow that, and as a result, he would just discuss it privately with me, and we ended up working together and putting it out for everybody. And it was one of the most successful files the French Connection has ever had. You'll recognize the name as Anonymous Andy from the Rothschild history. His name is actually Andrew Hitchcock, and I don't know if he's related to the great and famous film director, but I know Andrew has worked very diligently in putting together a very powerful file and a very powerful history of supremacy and financial manipulation of our world. And there are so many events in history that parallel this family's power and control, and how many other families are actually meshed in with them, and what goes on behind the scenes of this group. You know, before the French Connection really started talking about these people, there was scant place on the internet that you could find information about these people. So Andy has taken it upon himself to work his way through a book, made it available now, got a website, and we're going to bring Andy up right now and let him talk about it. Andy, are you with me?
Hi, Daryl. Yes, nice to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you all the way from outside of London. And, you know, I want to let you, first of all, tell everybody where to find your book information and your website. Could you give that information to start with?
Yeah, sure. My book is called The Synagogue of Satan, and the website is called thesynagogueofsatan.com. You can email me there as well, and you can buy the book online. It's £12, which includes postage worldwide. That's airmail, so you're not waiting 2 months to get it. And that's about $20.
Yeah, and it's quite an extensive book. I mean, how many pages are actually put together in this book?
Well, there's about 300 pages. What happened, obviously, working with you now for getting on for a year, Daryl, it's mm-hmm. been started off as a Rothschild article, which is took the form of a timeline.
Yeah.
And as you would put more interviews on with some of the great guests that you've had over the past, like Mohammed Rafik and David Pidcock and so many others, it's difficult to go through without, you know, doing them all justice, really. But they're two that come to mind straight away. I was able to make notes and then research those notes, and when I got enough research and I was happy that I had enough sources to put the information in the timeline, I would put it in and you would upload a new timeline. So we kind of kept updating over mm-hmm. a period of like nearly a year.
Right.
And it just got so big that it was just, people have, it's better to be in a book form, really, because people have a tendency to get tired reading long documents.
Well, I think the file has seen 95 or almost 100,000 downloads.
Gosh, that's
yeah.
a lot.
Yeah, it is. And what that translates to is that a whole lot of people are starting to understand the facts around this particular family. And, you know, there were even some supplemental facts that I'm going to bring up in this conversation that happened last night when I was talking to Eustace Mullins. And he talked about the Del Banco family being the Warburgs. And of course, they play a prominent role in the history of this Northern European family. But interesting that we should go right, I think, to the beginnings here. There is some vague areas that you and I discussed before we did the show today earlier about the real formation of this Bauer / Rothschild or Redshield family back in the mid 1750s and 60s. And there's really not a lot of evidence of how they got this mass fortune in advance of that. But could you give the listeners maybe a little snippet on how they claim the beginnings were?
Well, the claim is that our first Rothschild was born Mayor Amschel Bauer, in 1744, and that was in Frankfurt, Germany. His father was Moses Bauer, and he ran a counting house, so it was a sort of money-lending operation. Back then, traders, if you like, would tend to just have symbols above their shops and whatever businesses that they had, and the symbol that was above Bauer counting house was a red shield, which is basically what's known as the Star of David today, the same as you'll find on the Israeli flag, but obviously on the Israeli flag it's blue. And for some reason, Bauer decided, when he wasn't too old, I believe around 1760, which would have made him only 16 years old, but at that age, certainly his children were going into the business at the age of 12, so people would go into business earlier, and he decided to change his name from Bauer to Rothschild. Being German, Rothschild comes from Rothschild, which means red shield or sign.
Mm-hmm. Now, the fact is, he had quite a large family, didn't he?
Yes, he had five sons, and this is where a lot of the Masonic links come from, and people talk about these five sons and what have you, but a lot of people don't talk about the five daughters, which is something that I've been trying to look into, but information on them is very scant. But of course that's extremely interesting, because we've got all sorts of powerful families running around today that we can't link to this group, but you can't find where these daughters actually went to.
Well, what we do know also is that they are from the Ashkenazi or Khazarian connected form of Judaism, and that would have its roots in the steppes of Russia. Am I correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Mohammed Rafik explained it brilliantly, and I think Ted Pike also did a full program on the Khazarian connection. But the Rothschilds certainly descend from that side. They are Jewish, but they're from the Ashkenazi Jew line.
Have you ever seen any connections to the Frankist movement and any of that other connected? Because, as you know, later on, after the 1760s, there were new movements in the Northern European area that were, they can be described as Bohemian or New Bohemian. And some of these people, including a family named Solomon Bush, came out of this group and came over to America and were very prominent in setting up Masonic lodges in the United States. But do you see any connection to the Rothschild or Bauer family and any of the obvious movements like the Lubavitchers or Lubavitch, or do you see the Frankist movement, which was quite a powerful movement in the end of the 1780s and 90s was beginning to be formed. So did you see any connection to these families?
Well, certainly it appears that a lot of people came out at the same time. So it makes me wonder, whilst the Rothschilds are very, very powerful, how they actually acquired all this wealth, and whether this story about a father who had a counting house and Mayor Amschel Bauer changing his name to Rothschild and suddenly ending up with all this money, whether he was just a convenient front man then, as we have convenient front men today, and if really we were looking at a group that had been in control for many, many years prior to that. But this is the sort of first information that we can start to get a handle on this.
Yeah, and one of the things that I actually discussed with you today, which is, and this is something to look into, is the connection of Warburg family coming in out of Italy, and of course, you know, the De Medici family was instrumental in moving Jewish financiers around Europe in the beginning of the Renaissance period, when she was actually marrying Catherine de Medici, marrying into the French royal family, and she brought with her her financiers. But the family Warburg was at that time called El Banco, according to Eustace Mullen's research. And this is a very interesting connection, because the Warburgs are very integral in the Rothschild fortunes, aren't they not?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the links that I find with the Warburgs are more modern. They first pop up for me around the turn of the last century. And, of course, they were instrumental in the Federal Reserve. And I think even let me think, I think it was in 1950 that it was Paul Warburg who said that we will have world government either by consent or by conquest, words to that effect anyway.
Yeah. Well, and interestingly enough, these people are still very let's talk about two other families that actually hold prominence within the research as well, which is the Honig family out of Austro-Hungarian background, and also the Schiff family. And you'll find those people, including Warburg, Schiff, and Honig, are still on the Federal Reserve Board in America.
Well, yes, and of course, many of the listeners will know of Jacob Schiff, who was the main guy, if you like, who set up the Federal Reserve, and of course, he was born in the Rothschild home in Frankfurt.
Yeah, they actually were, I mean, that's as close to them as you can possibly get, isn't it?
Yeah, I think I found it quite strange, because you would think with all the money they have, but even sort of going back to the 1860s, I believe that there was the house in Frankfurt was shared by the Schiffs and the Rothschild family.
Yeah. Well, now we can take a look at some of the activities of this household and this family. What we do know is that there was a large segment of their fortune was made in a what I call a scam. They came in with back. They said that Napoleon Bonaparte had actually defeated the British forces in Waterloo and shipped that information to the British stock market. Did they not? And tell us that story.
Well, the story is that in 1812, in the war between the British and the French, the Rothschild family were funding both sides. And this was really, I think, the earliest indication of when they were funding both sides in wars. And this was another reason that people say that the Rothschilds are so influential, because it was kind of the start of moving central banking to different countries. So you had these five sons of the first Rothschild, and they each set up central banks in, obviously one in Germany, you have one that went over to France, one in England, and so on. And so you had two members of the same family funding opposing forces in war. And what essentially happened was the British stock market, as this war was going on, they knew of the influence of Rothschild, who was actually Mason Rothschild, and he made out while he was on the floor of the stock exchange that the British had actually lost the war, and he did this by looking forlorn and starting to sell Comstalls, which are stocks and shares of that day, which caused the other traders to panic, and they all offloaded the their stocks for pennies on the dollar, at which point Rothschild instructed his agents to start buying them up. And interestingly, there was a story, a descendant in America about 100 years later, this is in my book, actually tried to sue someone for bringing this story out in the American court, and they lost and had to pay the court costs. So it certainly haven't been able to disprove the story.
Well, and one of the things that you and I discuss is the truth is your best defense when you're faced with this. This is certainly not an attempt to create slander here, but rather to correct what many people perceive as a false history that's in our history books. And you cannot have a good grasp of history without understanding the relationship these people have in the world and what kind of actual control they've exerted. Did you find information about the Civil War in the United States and this family?
Oh, yes. I believe with the Civil War, and let me just turn to, because we've got people like August Belmont, who's Rothschild descendant, getting involved. There's a greater area on the Civil War, and of course there's a lot of questions over Abraham Lincoln, because some people say he was actually a Rothschild descendant, and there are parallels with him and Kennedy as to whether they were people that were doing the bidding of the Rothschilds and suddenly turned against them by printing their own money, and were subsequently assassinated by Rothschild.
Did you know that was called becoming a Bonapartist?
No, I didn't.
Yes, and that has been, I've discussed this with several historians. To be a Bonapartist is to go off the reservation on these bankers. And Stalin became a Bonapartist as well. He was placed in power sometime, forward in history. We can discuss that later. But he went off the reservation a bit and started shutting these financiers out of their activity. But anyway, going back to this Civil War period, they were actually one of the agents of Jefferson Davis's government was a Jewish financier right from the Rothschild Bank that was helping to support the Confederacy and finance its money. Am I correct in that?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Certainly, the way that it was going with this war, with the South almost put in an impossible position due to there was, I think, certain levies that were being placed on them with cotton trades and what have you, and so the war was almost engineered and it had to occur.
Yeah. Well, and here, so what they were doing is just another form of financing both sides both sides toward the middle, and I think the 1812 war with the United States also had backing of Rothschild. It was when they bombed the Washington D.C. and the White House got bombed in 1812. But that was also engineered through Rothschild engineering from behind as well.
Oh, absolutely. The reason for that war was the first central bank of the United States was set up in 1791, and it had a 20-year charter, and this was by a Rothschild agent, Alexander Hamilton, in, I believe, George Washington's cabinet, and this charter was not being renewed, and this is when we have a few interesting quotes from Nathan Rothschild. Just to clarify, Nathan Rothschild was the second generation Rothschild, who became the head of the family after Mayor Amschel, who was the original one who changed his name from Bauer to Rothschild, died. And he made a few interesting... Here we are, 1811. The charter for Rothschild's Bank of the United States runs out and Congress votes against the renewal. Nathan Mayer Rothschild is not amused and he states, either the application for renewal of the charter is granted or the United States will find itself involved in a most disastrous war. However, the United States stands firm and the charter is not renewed, which causes Nathan Mayer Rothschild to issue another threat in which he states, teach those impudent Americans a lesson, bring them back to colonial status.
Mm-hmm. So, now, you and I both know that the 1812 attempt by the British failed for a second time, and what was the result of that? There was a long period where there was banking independence in the American colonies, was there not? Well, in the American nation.
Well, they did actually get their bank through, I believe, in 1815, and this was another 20-year charter, and this was the one that preceded the long period of so-called American independence, which was thanks to President Andrew Jackson, who, suffered numerous assassination attempts by the Rothschilds, and he wasn't afraid to say as such. And he even when he was buried and he destroyed the second central bank, of course, the one we just talked about was the first that resulted in this war, and I think the second was starting about 1815. When he died, I think about 10, 12 years later, he actually put on his headstone, I killed the bank. And that was his, what he considered his, greatest achievement in his life.
Well, and we know that, John Wilkes Booth, the person responsible for shooting, Lincoln, was actually an agent that could be traced back to, Rothschild as well. And that has also been, rather roundly, accepted in historical circles. Have you read the same?
Oh, definitely. There's a book called This One Mad Act by John Wilkes Booth's granddaughter. Her name's Isola Forrester. And she states in her book that he'd been put up to the assassination by powerful interests in Europe. And contrary to reports that he was killed by the American authorities, he actually escaped to Europe and died in Calais at the age of 39.
Well, you see... We're meandering around history here, and of course we're not staying quite close to the chronology. However, what I am building here is a picture of nefarious treachery and criminality that stretches back centuries and probably far further than that. What would you say was the next big thing? Because I take a look at the 1913 central bank decision, and you see the Federal Reserve coming into power right when America was becoming a superpower in the world of manufacture. And it seems to me that we could draw a parallel to the 1913 America and what we see in China right now. And by the way, Lazard Frères, the Rothschild Bank, is the only foreign bank allowed to trade internationally the Chinese renminbi and the debt right now. So in other words, my point being is I see a parallel about 100 years later happening in China. Could you discuss that 1913 event in America and how what they did and what were some of the consequences you discovered?
Well, I mean, the 1913 event was, of course, the foundation of the Federal Reserve, and it was essentially ensuring that this family, through different through so-called other banks, I think we've got about 13 or so banks, I have a list of them somewhere in this book, who actually controls the Federal Reserve. And when you look at each of these banks, they all go back to this Jewish group. And essentially what they needed to do was they needed to set up a central bank to get control of the money supply and then set up taxation in order to get the interest paid for the money.
Here's one of the sticking points. The American Constitution requires two-thirds of the states to ratify a national tax, because it was clearly stated in the original documents that taxation was done by the government and for the government, but would not be done on a federal level on wages, on people's earned effort. And, of course, that changed even without the law. In other words, they used the color of law, but never a ratified law. And so, basically, employment taxes that are levied on Americans federally are a crime.
Oh, absolutely. And there's even, I think, I put together an article on the money system that's up on your site. And there's actually a link on that to a guy that does not pay income tax. He's been to court over it, and he's got his own website to advise others as to look into it themselves.
And there were some other things that happened then too. There was any lands west of the Mississippi became collateral against the loans. Now, I'm not sure when this happened. Maybe you have the information. Was this 1933 when America was declared bankrupt?
There was a period of what the bankers wanted to do was that they wanted the idea of producing the money is to get control of the property, really, because if you've got an area that's got a certain amount of money in it, say a million, and then a central bank set up and they just pump more and more money into that economy, then if the million dollars represents the whole economy and they produce $4 million and put that into the economy, then the original million is only worth 20%, because the economy is, of course, now $5 million as opposed to $1 million.
That's right.
And this is what the plan has always been, to get people into debt and then to suddenly pull the plug and start pulling all this money out of the economy, so people end up literally losing their businesses, their homes, and then these bankers can actually get it in that way.
And I understand that what happened also, I mean, you basically, when you buy a piece of property in any state west of the Mississippi, the land that you buy is not necessarily your land, but rather a deed, a title to use the land, but not to own it. The ownership is actually held in trust under Rothschild banking control in some way.
I'm not sure. That's not an area that I've actually looked into. I was aware that of the business with certainly coming up to the depression that you talked about, when they were looking to get control of a lot of farms in that area.
Yeah.
But the actual title deeds and what have you, I think Eustace Mullins certainly in I think one of his books, I can't think of the title, but I think that he's a good one to talk to about that.
Well, yeah, and one of the other things that happened as well that I remember, and I read so many things that I can't instantly put them back out, but federal lands, the ones that they keep saying are going to be used in the West for national parks and such and so forth, hold massive amounts of mineral wealth and natural resource wealth that is actually part of the collateral that was held up in 1933 to secure a loan to bring America out of bankruptcy. And do you know anything about that?
I don't know that specific it being brought up for the bankruptcy situation, but certainly the environmental movement is something that the Rockefeller family have used in order to seize assets and kind of sit on them, and they do that throughout Africa and then as well. And it's always conveniently seen to be rich in minerals also.
Oh, boy, so, you know, a tangled web. It's unbelievable. Let's move forward here to present day. Let's go back 50 years almost into the 1960 election of Kennedy. What did you find that Kennedy did or did not do that was rather suspicious or in other words, lead you to believe he was running afoul of these bankers?
Well, there's a couple of things that, with regard to the Kennedy assassination, the most popular view is this Executive Order 11110, in which Kennedy returned the power to issue money to the United States government, and he started issuing United States notes as opposed to going to the Rothschild Federal Reserve, and this was exactly the same as what Abraham Lincoln did. He started to print his own money. Which was printed by the US government at the time, because the Constitution gives them that power. Going back to that point, I have heard other research that Kennedy didn't actually issue his own notes. He was merely reissuing the greenbacks that were issued by Abraham Lincoln. So there's sort of two schools of thought on that, but I'm fairly happy with the fact that he was certainly issuing some of his own money. But I think that the main reason that he was assassinated was that he was making it clear to the Israeli Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion that he was not prepared in any way to let Israel become a nuclear state. And there's a quite interesting quote, I think the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, and this was dated February the 5th, 1999, in a review of Avner Cohen's book entitled Israel and the Bomb, state the following. The murder of American President John F. Kennedy brought an abrupt end to the massive pressure being applied by the U.S. administration on the government of Israel to discontinue the nuclear program. The book implied that had Kennedy remained alive, it is doubtful whether Israel would today have a nuclear option. And there's another interesting point here. John F. Kennedy's wife, Jackie Kennedy, was Jewish. Now, this is revealed by Gore Vidal, and this is in his autobiography Palimpsest, a memoir. It turns out that Gore Vidal's stepfather, Hugh Orchidloss, subsequently he had wed Jackie Kennedy's mother, Janet Bouvier, and this was reported in the New York Times on November 9th, 1995, and this is how this story came out.
And so, and she went on to marry a Jewish shipping heir out of Greece, didn't she?
Oh, yes. Onassis.
Onassis.
Yeah. And interestingly, I mean, there are obviously other views on who really was responsible for the death of Kennedy. I don't remember seeing either of these stories in the film JFK, but Oliver Stone is also Jewish.
Yes. No surprises there. Well, so we take a look at this now. What interest have you found that the Rothschilds have in the formation and the general running of Israel? And it's we go back to Balfour for a moment here. Now, we've talked about the financial side of this Rothschild cabal here or group. What is it What is it that you discovered that Morgenthau and Brandeis and the rest from America had to do with him and coming over to Britain for Balfour and the rest?
Well, if I can just jump back for a minute with regard to what you first said about Rothschilds and Israel, it really is my research has pointed to the fact that Israel was their private country. And at the end of the day, to have a country, you need a population. If you had one family that occupied a lot of land and called it a country, with the money that they have, they could have done that, but it wouldn't get any support, or it wouldn't be able to have any voice if you just had a few hundred people living there. So what they've always needed is a population. And the whole idea that seems to come out about the First and Second World Wars is it was really to form the country of Israel.
And probably to weaken the European nations so that Israel, by weakening Western countries and by building a very wealthy and stable Middle Eastern country, they would immediately be a powerful nation in their own right, especially if they hold a nuclear option.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that really the way that they've gone about it is quite unbelievable. I say it's unbelievable to the rational person, but because they've been able to get control of the media and they control the money as well, they've been able to kind of hide the atrocities that they've had to commit in order to bring this state to a reality.
Yeah. Now, let's talk for a minute about their relationship to Oppenheimer and South Africa. There was a time, the British will remember this, the Boers War. The Boer War was a war that Britain participated in, lost a lot of troops, murdered a lot of people in Africa, many families, and it was all at the urgings and demands of the Rothschild fortune in London. And ultimately, what happened is they took control of the mineral rights in the country of South Africa, and they hold that still to today through the De Beers monopoly. And do you have any information on Oppenheimer and his contribution to the Rothschild fortunes?
Well, of course, when Rothschild started out, he was working for an Oppenheimer bank. When we're talking about the first Rothschild, and then he took over his father's counting house, and this is where he's suddenly supposed to have come into all this money, which asks questions to whether he was actually a front man as well.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, I've got some interesting things on the Boer War. Firstly, Boer actually means farmer.
Yep.
And a lot of people, it's important to point that out because then people can see it's actually a war against farmers.
Yeah.
So it clarifies it. But there's a speech that Rear Admiral Henry Hamilton Beamish gave on October the 30th, 1937, on the subject of the Boer War. He said, "The Boer War occurred 37 years ago. Boer means farmer. Many criticised a great power like Britain for trying to wipe out the Boers. Upon making inquiry, I found all the gold and diamond mines of South Africa were owned by Jews, but Rothschild controlled gold, Samuels controlled silver, Baum controlled other mining, and Moses controlled base metals. And the president of South Africa back in 1899 had the following to say in relation to this war. He said, if it were conceivable to reject the Jew monopolist from this country, South Africa, net and crop, without incurring war with Great Britain, then the problem of everlasting peace would be solved. So what he's saying there is that he knows who's behind it, but they're using the British, the British forces to achieve it, just the same as these same people are using American forces in Iraq and Afghanistan and British forces today.
Yeah. You see, the more things change, the more they stay the same, Andy. And I got to tell you, when you take a look at these events, you don't see them in your history books. You'll see the Boer War described quite differently than you just did.
Well, one thing that always sticks in my mind, and I forget the interview now, but you did an interview once and you said there's always been something about history that didn't quite make sense. And that's very true. Mm-hmm. And looking into this, I was amazed at how, even obviously researching very deeply as you can, but how things slot into place and make much more sense than they ever did when you really looked at them, at school or what have you.
Well, you know, the wars that have been raging in the Congo region of Africa and the between the Hutus and the Tutsis and so many other places like Senegal over diamonds and oil and the rest and what's happening in Nigeria right now, you will find an agent of this particular group behind every single one of those events.
Oh, absolutely. And it begs the question then as to, you know, whether we're actually really dealing with just money or whether there's some sort of satanic element as well, because sometimes you look at all that's going on and you think, well, wouldn't there be an easier way for them to get what they want without all this bloodshed? But they seem determined to have that go hand in hand with it.
Well, now you see, I don't know how much credence I put in the reality of Satanism and all the rest. However, do you believe in your research that these people do?
Yes, I think it's... It really comes down to Talmudic belief, and you talked about that a lot. And I mean, essentially, to sum it up, is just a case of where the Jewish Talmud teaches Jews that they're the chosen people; everybody else is just cattle, and it's just for them to do as they please. And they have little quotes like, you know, a Jewish fingernail is not worth one non-Jew, etc., etc. And so this is where, you know, the confusion is as to whether they're doing this deliberately to sort of, you know, have a bit of fun with wiping a few non-Jews out, or whether they've got a serious motive that they actually want to get control. I think it's probably both. This is why it makes it quite difficult to always work out what they're going to do next. I mean, when an event happens, it's very easy once an event happens to sort of say, oh, that sounds, you know, like sort of something like 9/11, when you see the benefit out of that, but of course, you know, getting the West against the Muslim world, which was something Albert Pike talked about, you know, I think 1880, when he was working on behalf of the Rothschild family and planning three world wars. But at the same time, you can't always predict what they're going to do,
but interesting too, though, that they're not. They have no reluctance to include in the slaughter their own Jewish brethren, especially if they come from a Semitic background. And it's interesting because they're always claiming, if you bring these facts out, that you're anti-Semitic. Yet the Semitic Jew has been one of the biggest victims of these folks.
Oh, absolutely. There was a gentleman called, what was his name? He wrote a book called My Life in Racist Marxist Israel. David Pidcock mentioned it name was Jack Bernstein.
Yes.
He published a book called The Life of an American Jew in Racist Marxist Israel, in which he wrote the following statement under the heading A Challenge. Now, this is an American Jew. He says, I'm well aware of the tactics of you, my Zionist brethren. Sorry, I'll start again. I'm well aware of the tactics that you, my Zionist brethren, use to quiet anyone who attempts to expose any of your subversive acts. If the person is a Gentile, you cry, you're anti-Semitic, which is nothing more than a smokescreen to hide your actions. But if a Jew is the person doing the exposing, you resort to other tactics. First, you ignore the charges, hoping the information will not be given widespread distribution. If the information starts reaching too many people, you ridicule the information and the person's giving the information. If that doesn't work, your next step is character assassination. If the author or speaker hasn't been involved in sufficient scandal, you're adept at fabricating scandal against the person or persons. If none of these are effective, you are known to resort to physical attacks, but never do you try to prove the information wrong. And that's what he said in his book.
Yeah, and it's interesting that during the migration of many of the northern European Jews, I think the people that ended up in the work camps of Germany and Poland and other were the ones that were reluctant to be part of that migration. You can talk about the 51 documents, or you can talk about the transfer agreement. And what you find is that there were a lot of Jewish people who were cosmopolitan, who found themselves quite comfortable in Germany. They had a very good relationship with the Germans before, of course, you know, the 1930s attacks that came out of America. But the interesting thing is that they have been used as victims and as dupes in many instances just as the rest of us have been victimized.
Well, exactly. I mean, I've got here a quote from Isaac Greenbaum, who was the head of the Jewish Agency Rescue Committee. This is 1943. In a speech to the Zionist Executive Council, he stated, "If I am asked, could you give from the United Jewish Appeal monies to rescue Jews, I say no, and I again say no." He goes on to state, "One cow in Palestine is worth more than all the Jews in Poland."
Yeah.
And I think what has happened, and is that, as you mentioned, these 51 documents, the idea was to frighten the Jews into leaving this area and going to Israel to give the Rothschilds their population, if you like. And the people that wouldn't go were the people that suffered.
That's right.
And of course,
and they actually, the Germans actually coined a silver coin with the Star of David on it. And I just saw this recently, and I was really knocked over by it. But it was actually has on one side of it has the swastika, and on the other side the Star of David. And it talks about Palestine on this German coin.
Well, that sounds fascinating. You'll have to send that information over to me.
Yeah, and not only that, when you take a look at you know the way that this was formed in the minds of the rest of the world immediately after, they didn't talk about the facts after the war as we do today, because the story hadn't even been formed at that time. Now, you know, I live in a hate crimes country, and I've never looked into the Holocaust and the claims made about it, but I have looked at the lead up to that war period in the Balfour signings, and then of course World War I was in fact the prelude to this very big push on Palestine, was it not?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the Balfour Declaration, what's so amazing about the Balfour Declaration is that it starts off, "Dear Lord Rothschild." Now, at the end of the day, what we're looking at here is we're looking at a declaration in which let me just see if I can find the exact text. I think that this is November 2nd, 1917. "Dear Lord Rothschild, I have much pleasure in conveying to you on behalf of His Majesty's Government the following declaration of sympathy with Jewish Zionist aspirations, which has been submitted to and approved by the Cabinet. His Majesty's Government view with favour the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavours to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. I should be grateful if you would bring this declaration to the knowledge of the Zionist Federation. Yours sincerely, Arthur James Balfour." But the interesting bits here is it says no problems for existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine. Well, we all know what happened there. But it also goes on to say all the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, less than 20 years later, we've got these 51 documents coming into play, which was a collaboration between the Zionists and the Nazi regime to bring the Jewish people out of Germany into Israel.
Well, we know that Max Warburg was very instrumental in arranging financing, both from America, from Britain, and from other parts of the world, and funneling it into the war machine that Hitler was constructing.
Oh, absolutely, and there's some astonishing information on Hitler, and I refer to it, there are all sorts of rumours as to who he was. Again, I find it very, very difficult to believe that a guy who was in the trenches and got injured in the First World War suddenly becomes as powerful as he does. And I would question as to what he really was there for. But the facts that we know about is that we know that he... it is a fact that he was trying to get Jews out of Germany. But back in the early 30s, when he was doing so, he was doing it with the cooperation of the Zionist regime, because they both wanted the same thing. He wanted the Jews, we're told, out of Germany, and of course they wanted a population in Palestine.
Well, there was a mutual need from both of them to cooperate at the very least, and possibly it was more than that. Maybe it was just a design of both of them. You know, I mean, maybe he was integral in the whole execution of this plan from the beginning. Maybe he wasn't used in any way. Maybe he was part of the management.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, there are people that say that he was actually a Rothschild illegitimate, but the sort of basis for that is, I believe, is his grandmother was made president in Austria, and the only large house in Austria was owned by I think Salomon Rothschild, and so there's nothing that you can pull together. So it's very sort of, it's based on conjecture, that is.
How about some of his henchmen? Did you find anything in your research that indicated that his leadership or part of his management team of the regime were actually from the Jewish community?
Well, there's strong rumors. There's one book that actually talks about Hitler's Jewish soldiers, and it goes into great detail, but it's the only source that I found for it. So I haven't used it in the book because...
Well, that's probably a fair thing to do.
I need sort of multiple sources. But, of course, people like Eichmann and what have you, there's a lot of history with them as to whether they were Jewish.
Now, I've got a question. The viciousness that you see these wars committed in, I mean, they keep building more powerful and more destructive and more violent weaponry to do more mass murder. I mean, if you go back 1,000 years, you could kill 100 in a battle, and then it went up to 1,000. Now it's millions died in the First World War, and then tens of millions in the Second. Where are we heading with this, and is there a demand of this group to see large masses of non-Ashkenazis to die in war? I mean, I have to wonder what the motivation is here, because it seems like if they're financing it and then they're propagating it and then millions are dying, is it by design or is it? Come on, this is some horrible stuff we're examining here.
Well, this is where I go back to whether, there is this sort of evil element to it, because again, as you say, it's so astonishing what they're up to, if this is just for profit, and certainly with the weaponry, the idea that I believe that Israel is looking to reestablish its biblical borders. I think that on the Israeli flag, you've got the blue line at the top and the blue line at the bottom, with the Star of David, the old Rothschild star, in the middle. I believe the line at the top and the line at the bottom represent the Nile and the Euphrates rivers, and their aim is to have all the land in between, which would include places like Iraq, Iran, and what have you. But of course, you have to wonder what use that land is going to be for anything other than that we have it, when it's polluted by depleted uranium. And if you look at some of the pictures on the internet, which are probably some of the most gruesome I've ever seen, and that's of the children that have been born in, going back to after the first Gulf War, with the most horrific birth defects I think I've ever seen.
Well, yeah, in fact, levels of that radiation are being recorded all over the globe, in fact, and maybe these people don't care how many of the Jews and Gentiles they kill, because uranium is going to kill indiscriminately. I wonder what you find the flow of this history is, Andy. Where are we heading with this terrible story? I mean, I it's hard. This is speculative at this moment, but it begs the question of where we're going with this. I mean, this is some awful stuff.
Well, this is the thing, isn't it? It does worry me, because it seems to just escalate, and it just gets more and more, as time passes, and there doesn't seem to be any sort of holding this group back. Whoever gets into power, it still continues. And, my view certainly on this group is that if it takes them, 10 years, they'll do it in 10 years, but if it'll take them 1,000 years, they'll still do it over 1,000 years. I mean, they've got their aim. I believe that their ultimate aim is to establish certainly their own group as a world government over everybody else, and it just remains to be seen as to how everybody else is treated, because of course they still will need people to do things for them.
Yeah.
But what amazes me is that so few questions are asked. I think Eric does a wonderful job when he points out about the compliance of the media and what goes on. I mean, we were just talking about the uranium, you know, these nuclear weapons being used, and all sorts of conventions being broken on the weapons that are being used, and all that these politicians want to talk about is pedantics about it, rather, and they're not even pressed on these issues.
Yeah. Well, what we did today, and I want, could you give your website again and the details of how to get there for the people, the name of the book, and you, of course, your name is Andrew Hitchcock, and my friend Anonymous Andy, if you've read the files on the website.
Yeah, thank you, Darrell. It's www.thesynagogueofsatan.com.
Mm-hmm.
And on the site there is, it's only a few pages. It's basically, it gives you the chance to read a few sample chapters of the book. There's a PayPal button that you can buy it for £12, what's that, about $20, and that will get, that includes the postage to anywhere in the world, first class in the UK or airmail to everywhere else.
Well, there we go. You know, usually I stop these after an hour because it gives everybody an opportunity to digest this information. And, of course, this is an ongoing story, and we are going to revisit it again together. Of course, maybe in a few weeks from now, we'll speak privately and see what kind of addendums and maybe some things we didn't add to this, and we'll pick another spot in history and do another color commentary on that. But let it be known, Andy, that this is a chronology of this activity that you've put down here. So if people want to use this as a historical basis for research, it has certainly got all the earmarks of a historically researched book, does it not?
Yes, I mean, the way that I've set it out is it's not your conventional book, because it just we'll have a year and we'll have what happens in that year. But the reason I did it is I became a researcher because I was interested in the subject, and a lot of the difficulties that you find is pinning the dates down. And I remember indeed I had some problems with something that President Jackson said, and I had it, I had to change it a couple of times in the Rothschild article until I was happy with when it actually was said. But as I say, to put it in this way, people are able to look at the facts, they're able to do simple searches on Google or whatever they want to use, and then satisfy themselves with those facts when they get the multiple sources that come up.
Well, and Andrew, you know, this has been a very powerful interview. It's been a very powerful discussion today. I want to thank you for spending this time with the French Connection listeners. And, you know, our goal here is to inform and to allow people the ability to know the enemy and knowing what we're fighting against here. This is a real do or die situation. There are certainly no middle ground in this. If we don't all buck up right now and start making this a priority, we're going to become victims, I believe.
Oh, absolutely. And I, as I say, I'm one of your listeners. I've followed you since you started out, and I've followed lots of others who've all dropped off on certain other networks that we can mention. And really, if I want the truth, this is where to go to. And I just encourage people to look at your previous files and try and get out there and do something. You've got people like Jim Condit that are actually doing something, which I wish that we could have this sort of thing happening over where I am in the UK. And I think it's important for the listeners to do everything they can to get the information out, but primarily to try and think of ideas of how we can defeat these people and really take the power back for ourselves where it should be.
You're right. Well, you know, thanks for your efforts here. We're going to discuss more subjects, ladies and gentlemen, with my friend Andrew here in a later date. But you've got plenty to chew on here, and of course you can get his book at the details he gave you. You'll also find a link on our website and possibly some other links that we'll put together in a file to give you reference information from Mohammed Rafig and others. But please, take this and pass it around. Put it on a, possibly, ladies and gentlemen, put it on a CD and hand it out. Cost you a couple of quid for a few CDs. It won't be expensive. And burn them down and hand them out and get this word out and let people know what late hour it really is and what it is that we need to face. But until the next time, ladies and gentlemen, this is Darrell Bradford Smith telling you to be well. Bye-bye now.